are building a path for the peace paradigm. King and Gandhi, many more, have discovered something core. Now we're building a path for the peace paradigm. Every challenge is another highway sign on the path of the peace paradigm. Ooh, 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 ooh.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Peace Paradigm Radio, where we explore the power of active nonviolence and all of the issues related to making the world a safer and more secure place for human beings and all of life to thrive. How's that for a mission for a show? I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, director of the Meta Center for Nonviolence, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host and news anchor, Michael Negler, and we'll get to some nonviolence in the news on the second part of the show. However, let's go into our first interview today, which is with Alice Slater. Alice Slater is the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation's New York representative. She's a member of the Global Council for the Abolition 2000, which is a global network working for a treaty to eliminate nuclear weapons, and she directs the network's Sustainable Energy Working Group, which produced a model statute for an international renewable energy agency. She serves on the Coordinating Committee for World Beyond War, which you can find at worldbeyondwar.org, and she's also she calls herself a citizen activist who sometimes publishes pieces, for example, at The Nation. So we're very glad to have you here on our show today, Alice Slater.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So, Alice, let's just jump into the issue here that we're talking about, which is making the world safer. Don't nuclear weapons make us safer?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, even if we never use them in a war, there are so many records of accidental things. We had 36 airplanes crashed from 1950 to 1980 or so when we finally did the nuclear testing moratorium, carrying nuclear weapons. And none of them ever went off. I mean, we've just been lucky. About 2 years ago, a plane went from North Dakota to Louisiana carrying missiles loaded with nuclear weapons, and they didn't even know it was missing. And then they just made a movie, The Man Who Saved the World, about Colonel Petrov in a Russian missile silo who saw something coming in on his radar that was supposed to tell him to unleash all the Russian bombs and bomb all the U.S. cities, and he disobeyed orders, and it turned out it was a weather satellite that was off course. So there's all kinds of terrible accidents going on. At this point, we now have 16,000 nuclear weapons still on the planet, and 15,000 of them are in the U.S. and Russia. So it's really up to us. And of those, about 1,000 each in each country are on hair trigger alert, targeting all our cities. So this is a very important time to ratchet back the nuclear scare. And there's been some really promising events. There's what they're calling the humanitarian campaign to get a treaty to ban and prohibit nuclear weapons, just like the world has done for chemical and biological weapons. There is no treaty that says nuclear weapons are illegal. We have this non-proliferation treaty that was signed in 1970, where five nuclear weapon states, the U.S., Russia, England, France, and China, promised not to get nuclear weapons, and all the other countries of the world promised to give up their nuclear weapons, those five, U.S., Russia, China, England, France. All the rest of the countries of the world signed, except for India, Pakistan, and Israel. The other countries all promised not to get them. And then they tried to sweeten the pot with this inalienable right to peaceful nuclear power, which we then gave everyone the keys to the bomb factory. So North Korea was a member, and then they walked out of the treaty and took their peaceful nuclear power and enriched it and made a bomb. And that was part of what we were fighting over in Iran. They were using their peaceful nuclear power, and we didn't trust that they weren't enriching it to the level where it would have been bomb grade. So the Non-Proliferation Treaty said they were going to make good faith efforts in 1970 to get rid of their nuclear weapons. And instead of getting rid of them, Obama has now announced, for instance, that the U.S. is going to spend $1 trillion over the next 30 years for two new bomb factories and new delivery systems and new nuclear warheads. They just tested a new dummy warhead, a bunker buster in Nevada the summer before this. So as you can see, I mean, the nuclear weapon states are really putting everybody at risk, and the non-nuclear weapon states have taken the ball in their own hands. They did these series of conferences in Oslo, in Mexico, and in Vienna last year, over the last 2 years, on the humanitarian consequences of nuclear war, and they said, we have to ban these weapons. So they set up this special working group at the UN that just completed its meeting, and at this working group, the majority of countries voted that they're going to come to the UN General Assembly this fall and open up negotiations to ban the bomb. Now, the five nuclear weapon states, the original, the U.S., Russia, China, England, France, boycotted the meeting. And they actually, India, Pakistan, and North Korea didn't show up either. They had come to some of the earlier ones. So who is supporting this bomb? It's not just the nuclear weapon states, but the countries in the U.S. nuclear alliance, like all the NATO countries. We keep nuclear weapons in five NATO countries in Europe. We keep them in Italy, France, Germany, Holland, and Belgium. And then there's the Pacific countries under the U.S. nuclear umbrella, Japan, South Korea, and, Japan, South Korea, the ones and Australia is part of the umbrella. So these countries are supporting the nuclear weapon states. They're very hypocritical because they say we want to get rid of nuclear weapons because they say they don't have them, but they're in this alliance. And at the last non-proliferation treaty meeting last summer, every 5 years they have a review. They couldn't even agree on a final document. And South Africa got up and said, we are living under a condition of nuclear apartheid. There are nuclear haves and nuclear have-nots. And the nuclear haves are saying they need nuclear weapons for their security. Well, what about the rest of us? So the longer we hold on to them, the more countries are going to get them.
Alice.
Go ahead.
Now, that was wonderful, Alice Slater. Thank you for that backgrounder.
Right, that's to begin with.
I'm leading up to a tough question that I want us all to wrestle with. But on the way, I wanted you to comment on the accident in Palomares and on the recent fright that took place during the uprising at the Ankara Air Force Base, where we have missiles.
Exactly. I mean, Palomares is one of those 36 airplane crashes. I happen to have saved the congressional record because they were enumerating them at the time that we instigated a nuclear testing moratorium because Russia had already done it, then Soviet Union, and we got it done here. But Palomares, one of those planes that crashed, spewed plutonium. It didn't cause a nuclear bomb explosion, but the plutonium scattered, and they're still cleaning it up because this material is so lethal and toxic, it lasts for 300,000 years. I mean, we should not make one more bit of it. And the other thing, in Turkey is one of the NATO countries where we store our nuclear bombs, and that they were stored at the airport in outside of Ankara where we couldn't even get to them. Well, they all said they're safe, they're not connected to anything, they're in storage, but, you know, we don't want nuclear weapons in Turkey, and that brings me to another very interesting point, because when the war came down in Eastern Europe and the Cold War ended, Reagan and Gorbachev were talking about getting rid of all of the nuclear weapons. And they were going to do it. And Gorbachev said, but you can't do Star Wars. And Reagan said, I'm not going to give up Star Wars. So it was off the table. And Reagan also promised Gorbachev at that time that if they didn't object to East Germany being unified with West Germany and becoming part of our NATO alliance, we promised not to expand NATO. Now, Russia lost 27 million people to the Nazi onslaught. So they had plenty of, you know, gripes with Germany. But they said, okay, we won't object to East Germany going into NATO, but you promised not to expand it. Well, we've taken all of Eastern Europe into NATO, right up to Russia's border. We were even negotiating with Georgia and Ukraine. I mean, how would we feel if Russia put Mexico and Canada in their military alliance? And we know what happened when they put missiles in Cuba. I mean, we almost had World War III. And part of the deal that Kennedy made with Khrushchev to get the Soviet missiles out of Cuba was we would take our missiles out of Turkey. Well, guess what? They're back. So we are being so provocative. And on the space issue, Russia and China have been tabling a treaty since 2008 in the Commission on Disarmament in Geneva to negotiate a treaty to ban weapons in space. And every country votes it except the United States. And because that's a consensus-bound group of nations, we can't even talk about banning weapons in space. So if we're going to get rid of our nuclear weapons, like Putin offered Clinton, let's cut to 1,000 nuclear weapons each and then call everyone to the table, but don't put those new missile bases in Poland and Romania. And Clinton said, no deal. And then Bush actually walked out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty that we had with the Soviet Union, which promised that we weren't going to do that. Well, we just walked right out of the treaty, and we now have missile bases in Poland and Romania. So we're heating up a Cold War, and the only explanation, the only possible explanation, is certainly not making us safer, is what President Eisenhower warned about, the military-industrial complex. They now own all the television networks. They own the Congress. They own the president. I mean, there's so much corruption in this country that we can't say to our government, you know, talk to Russia, don't expand NATO. We should have disbanded NATO. It was a military alliance. I mean, the Warsaw Pact dissolved. Why do we need NATO? And NATO has a provision that we will use nuclear weapons on behalf of any NATO country if they're threatened, you know, to deter them. So this is where we are today.
Alice Slater of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, you're listening to Peace Paradigm Radio. This is a very, very informative report that we're getting from you, Alice. It's not reassuring, to say the least. As I understand it, there were 138 nations in that CWEG treaty plan that's going forward to the UN. Is that
right?
Correct? Yeah. Well, Alice, here's something that's really troubling me. I remember when the Indian underground explosion took place at Pokhara, I think, something like that.
Right.
Watching the news reports and the interviews with Indians and seeing the extent to which they felt that their manhood and their level of civilization was determined by their nuclear capability. And so
I'm sure that part of it in terms of the patriarchy running the show.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a lot of stuff that was going on that nobody realizes. I've been writing about it forever. You know, if I was on CNN or MSNBC, people would know this. But when we were, first of all, Kazakhstan was one of the Soviet Socialist Republics. They had a labor strike. They marched, this poet, Olga Suleymanov. They shut down the Soviet test site in Kazakhstan because there was so much cancer and childbirth defects, and they were able to get the Soviets to stop nuclear testing underground. We had we stopped atmospheric testing. Kennedy did that. But they only stopped testing it in the air. It went underground. We did like another 1,000 underground tests in Nevada, and the Soviets kept testing. So then we wanted the U.S. to stop. Well, they said to us, you can't trust the Russians. That's what the government was telling us. So this very wealthy guy that actually, Bill DeWin, he founded the National Resource Defense Council. He raised $6 million from private people. He was chairman of the New York City Bar Association. At that time, I was at the Lawyers Alliance for Nuclear Arms Control, so I knew him. And he raised $6 million. He hired a team of seismologists. We worked with the Soviet lawyers, and we put seismologists all over Russia that could test if they ever did a nuclear test. If they were cheating, we would know. You know, they could test these underground tremors. And then we came back to Congress, and we were able to get the Congress to put in a moratorium on nuclear testing. And eventually, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty was negotiated in Geneva. And Geneva, where I said you need complete consensus, India refused to agree to the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty unless we promise not to do the subcritical tests where they blow up plutonium with chemical explosives 1,000 feet below the desert floor in Nevada, but it doesn't have a nuclear detonation. It's just, you know, they just explode the materials, but it doesn't have, it's not a fissionable event. And Clinton said, well, that's not really a nuclear test. And India said, well, if you don't stop that and these laboratory tests, we have the National Ignition Facility at Lawrence Livermore. This is where the $1 trillion program is coming out of. That's 2 football fields long. That's testing, you know, atoms, smashing atoms in a laboratory. India said, if you don't stop that, we don't agree to the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, because they quietly had gotten their bomb in the 50s, and they just kept quiet, and they felt they were up to us, but they didn't want us to get ahead of the curve. And in an unprecedented move, the Australian ambassador, Richard Butler, part of this white colonial boys, you know, when you talk about the masculinity in India, it's all over. I mean, it's in the military-industrial complex. He brought that treaty to the UN without consensus, first time in history, and they opened it up for signature, and everybody's so happy, and India was, you know, odd man out, and then 3 months later, India tested, like, we're not going to be part of this, where we're left behind in the technology race. So they did their underground test so they could move to laboratory testing, you know, and get the information they needed to go to the next level. And Clinton, when he signed the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, promised this Faustian bargain. He promised the lab $6 billion a year, which is morphed into $1 trillion over 30, for what they were calling the Stockpile Stewardship Program. And that's when they did the laboratory test. They did 28 subcritical tests at the Nevada test site that we know about. Then they stopped reporting them about, Obama stopped reporting them. He's great on making everything a big secret. So now we don't even know if they're doing them anymore. But I'm sure they are, because they're still developing new weapons. Anyway, so yes, of course, the Indian scientists, you know, and the American scientists, it's like a very macho left brain kind of thing. I mean, they're not aware of what they're doing, because if this stuff lasts for 300,000 years and we don't know where to put it, how could we make any more of it aside from the bombs? Look at Fukushima. It's still pouring into the ocean and affecting the food supply. You know, Chernobyl is a sacrifice zone. It's like that's not even the bomb. That was like the peaceful atom. So, but I want to just say, these countries that are going ahead with the ban treaty, this is great, because if you notice, just this week we read that the cluster bomb manufacturers are going out of business in America. We never signed the cluster bomb treaty. I mean, Hillary Clinton wouldn't sign it when she was my senator, but they did pass a treaty that entered into force that got enough countries to say cluster bombs are banned, like we ban chemical and biological. And if we get a nuclear bomb ban, which we don't have yet, that will influence countries like Japan that are in our alliance and others to move away from relying on nuclear weapons, then it could put us, I mean, it's like a very good move forward.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Peace Paradigm Radio, and you're hearing Alice Slater, who is the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation's New York representative, and she's also on the coordinating committee for World Beyond War. Alice, you were just discussing this ban treaty for nuclear weapons as a step forward, and what you were saying before, you were every time you pointed to, well, there was an advance here, but then it was rolled back over here, or this is how the public attention was drawn to this issue, and then it became a secret issue after that. So where does the rubber hit the road for just the listeners of this show, regular activists in the world, maybe people, just regular citizens, really?
I have to tell you, yeah. I think right now Jill Stein is so fabulous. I happen to have met her at a UN demonstration on Fukushima. Mm-hmm. She calls me up when she's going on. You know, the stories I'm telling you, she's got them. She went to Russia and talked about it at a Russian meeting. She's been on Fox News now, on CNN. We have to get her into the debate, and Gary Younger, the libertarian, because, you know, like she says, Americans should have a right not just to vote, but to know who they're voting for. And she and Gary Younger in the Libertarian Party are on enough ballots that they can theoretically win the presidency, you know. So it's not like a fringe candidate. It's only a fringe because people aren't hearing it. So I would urge everybody to follow Jill. She knows everything I'm telling you now because I told it to her and she gets it and she believes it and she really wants to ban the bomb. And here in America, you know, we can't get our country probably to go along with the bomb treaty negotiations. But we have to soften the path. We'll never be able to talk to Russia until we dismantle NATO, until we agree to negotiate a space ban. I mean, Russia's been telling us for years they're not going to give up nuclear weapons if we're going to be superior in space. I mean, Cheney and those guys, they wrote this New American Century report, how we're going to dominate and control the military use of space. Well, Russia's not going to go along with that, you know, and they're trying to demonize Russia. I do not demonize Russia. I mean, nobody's a great guy, but, I mean, I wouldn't demonize them. I think they've been willing all along, and we've been recalcitrant. So it's hard to admit that as an American, you know, that, you know, like Pogo, this old comic strip from the 50s had this punchline, we met the enemy and he is us. I mean, that's what's going on now. We're like creating our own war. All these terrible wars we've had. All we have now is more migration, you know, more hunger and displaced people and more terrorism and more dead people. I mean, we killed 1 million people in Iraq. You never even hear about that. And Obama's doing these drones every week where they killed at least 1,000 innocent people, and he's judge, jury, executioner, figuring out who they're going to bomb on the ground. Some kid is sitting at a computer in Colorado dropping bombs on people in Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan. Why are we in all these places? They're not attacking us. We're creating more enemies and more danger for ourselves, our own security. There's now a great push out by Code Pink and other peace groups to have a moratorium on any arms sales. I mean, we're selling arms to Saudi Arabia that they're giving to terrorists and to, they're bombing Yemen. You know, why are we bombing Yemen? It's not our business. We should not be selling arms. We should have a moratorium. One of the best things I read this week was that the cluster bomb manufacturers are going out of business. We did that because we banned those bombs. And even though our country wouldn't sign the treaty, it just became not right to use them, you know. Although we have been giving some to Saudi Arabia that's using them in Yemen, but they're just not that popular anymore, you know. And that's, we have to stigmatize the bomb. That can happen this year by the non-nuclear weapon states, and then hopefully peel people out of the nuclear umbrella, the alliance.
Alice Slater, can you talk? So what I'm hearing here in terms of helping citizen activists and just citizens out there who would like to see a different age where nuclear weapons are banned. You're suggesting some talking points, I think, for people who want to get out there to write about this or to talk within their local community, including understanding the interconnection of the issues between, you know, nuclear weapons and the military-industrial complex and war and drones, as well as...
Let's not face the existential crisis. Let's not forget this crisis of global warming. I mean, with the scientists are telling us the oceans are going to rise 9 feet by 2050 if we don't do something. And Jill Stein has this fabulous program for a new Green Deal with 20 million jobs and putting everybody to work. And we know, if you look at the solutionsproject.org, that we have all the technology we need to do the sun and the wind and geothermal and efficient. We don't need oil, gas, or nuclear. We can absolutely fix our country, but it's got to be geared up like the Manhattan Project, like putting a man on the moon, like how we prepared for World War II after Pearl Harbor. We're facing this, aside from the nuclear crisis, we're facing the climate crisis. And, you know, we're being distracted with all this. All our IQ points and money, you know, like we're spending more money than all the other countries on the planet combined on the military. We have something like 800-900 military bases, and the whole rest of the world has 30. I mean, what are we doing? When did the U.S. become an empire?
Alice Slater.
I just want to say this, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was this Carter's foreign policy guy and the architect of the empire. You know, he was an Eastern European, and when the wall came down, he was saying how America had to be the one great leader for the whole planet. He just wrote an article saying that we can't do this anymore. We have to talk to Russia and China. That's like when McNamara said we had to get rid of nuclear weapons. This is such a big deal that he's saying that. We have to talk about that.
Well, Alice, that is indeed an encouraging note in all of this. And I just want to say parenthetically, as an old New Yorker, that I just love your accent. But here's the question that I think we should all be pondering. I've read that the average age of a treaty is 2.5 years. And I'm not saying that this treaty movement is the wrong thing to do, but from the nonviolence point of view, it may be necessary but not sufficient. And what we should be thinking about is what else do we do? Where do we put teeth into that earnest desire among people to have a nuclear-free world?
Right. I mean, I'd have to look at that. Yeah, I'm a lawyer, but I think we've had treaties. I mean, the UN, we signed that as a treaty where we promised to end the scourge of war. We had the Kellogg-Briand Pact. I mean, they never went away. It's just that we disobey them. We don't pay attention to them. I mean, Bush literally walked out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty, but where else? I mean, right now, this is like a wonderful little thing that's coming up at the UN this fall where we can literally get a bunch of countries to get together, write a document and sign it saying nuclear weapons are illegal, they're prohibited, they're banned. That's great. It's a treaty is good just to hold up as, you know, this is the idea whose time has come. And to put it out as a meme, you know, nuclear weapons are illegal, they're banned, they're prohibited. Nobody talks about them that way. We keep saying we need them for our deterrence. You know, what are we deterring? But what can we do? I mean, I just think everybody should get to work for Jill Stein right now and get her on in the debate. She's on the ballot. I think it can make a huge difference. I mean, if you're living in a state where you're terrified of Donald Trump, you know, okay, but if you live in a state like California or New York, you don't have to be terrified of Donald Trump, and you can give Hillary a little scare because she's a total war hawk. She wants to bomb Syria. Obama had to rein her in, you know. She wouldn't sign the cluster bomb treaty when she was my senator from New York, and she wouldn't vote for that in the Senate a few years back. So I think right now that's everything, like just petition the networks, petition the reporters to let them debate. They're on enough ballots that they can win, both of them, the Libertarian and the Green Party. They should be in the debate. It shouldn't be come to Hillary and Donald Trump trading insults is where it's going to wind up. We need a few issues because the thing that's really missing is public information right now. And what's helping us is the Internet. You know, Bernie did fabulous. He had 20, 30,000 people at a rally. You know, I mean, it was really moving. Of course, the powers that be, you know, put a wrench in the works. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't keep going. You know, we can keep going. And I think people are starting to see it. Even this popularity for Trump is coming from disaffected people that don't trust government. I mean, they've gone the wrong way. But if we could put something better in its place and get all their kids to go to college again. I mean, when I went to Queens College in 1954, it was $5 a semester. Nobody believed me. I mean, Jill Stein is campaigning on that, free college for everybody and forgive the debt. So, and put everybody to work with this Green New Deal, just like Roosevelt did after the Depression. We have to get to work on the climate or we're all doomed. You know, we're on this little boat. The Earth. We saw it for the first time in the 60s, this beautiful blue orb floating in space. I mean, we never even saw the Earth like that, small and beautiful, you know.
Alice Slater, thank you so much for joining us here on Peace Paradigm Radio and feeling very inspired to get involved and to learn more of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. The website is wagingpeace.org, and for World Beyond War, it's worldbeyondwar.org. And
can I just say one quick thing about World Beyond
absolutely.
War? Absolutely. I love this group. It's about 2 years old. The purpose is to get everybody, you should all go to the website and sign the pledge that you're going to be responsible for ending war on the planet, like to make it an idea whose time has come. Because if we get like millions of people saying, let's end war, and we're talking about it, it's like what Occupy Wall Street did, that we finally learned about the 1% and the 99%. World Beyond War is going to get enough people talking and thinking. They're having a conference. You can go to their website, www.worldbeyondwar.org, September 23rd to 25th in Washington, to get this idea out that it's possible to end war, that it's a myth that we always have to have war, you know, that we know how to do it. We have all kinds of peace studies. And just get more and more people talking about it and saying, you know, war is so 20th century. You know, it's just not working. And, of course, if we get rid of the bomb, I mean, that'll be a terrific marker on the road to ending war. That's like this, Kennedy called it the sword of Damocles hanging over us. So.
Thank you very much, Alice Slater, and we hope to have you back on our show.
Oh, thank you very much.
I'm gonna preach you a sermon about old man Adam, and I don't mean Adam in the Bible, Dadam. I don't mean Adam that Mother Eve mated. I mean that thing that science liberated. Einstein says he's scared. And if Einstein's scared, boy, I'm scared. Well, if you're scared of the A-bomb, here's what to do. You got to join with all the people in the world with you. Cause if we don't get together and do it well, first thing you know, we'll blow this world to... Moral as plain as day. Old man Adam is here to stay. He's gonna stick around, it's plain to see. But ah, my dearly beloved, are we? We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men may be cremated equal. You know, life used to be such a simple joy. The cyclotron was just a super toy. Folks got born, they'd work and marry, and Adam was a word in the dictionary. Then it happened. These science guys from every clime, they all pitched in with overtime. Before you knew it, the job was done. They'd hitched up the power of the doggone sun, put a harness on old Sol. Splitting atoms right and left, while the diplomats were splitting hairs. Of course, the cartel crowd up and put on a show. They're gonna turn back the clock on the UNO. Grab a corner on atoms and maybe extinguish every darn atom can't speak English. Down with foreign-born atoms, America for American atoms. Step right up, folks, and atomize world peace. But the atoms international, in spite of hysteria, flourishes in Utah, also Siberia. Whether you're white, black, red, or brown, the question is this, when you boil it down, to be or not to be, that is the question. Atoms to atoms and a dust to dust. If you listen to the money bag, something's bound to bust. Yes, it's up to the people, cause the atom don't care. You can't fence him in, he's just like air. He don't give a darn about any politics or who got what into whichever fix. All he wants to do is sit around and have his nucleus bombarded by neutrons. Now, the answer to it all ain't military datum, like who gets there fustest with the mostest atoms, but the people of the world must decide their fate. We gotta stick together or disintegrate.
Thank you, Pete Seeger. This is Michael Nagler of Peace Paradigm Radio, and it is time for Nonviolence in the News. And as usual, I'm going to try to talk about some resources and some news and some events. And there sure is a lot in each of those categories. For one thing, author Sarah Jaffe, who writes for Nation Institute and In These Times and has done a lot of wonderful writing, is bringing out a new book called Necessary Trouble. And what she has done is looked very closely at this phenomenon of mostly American but also worldwide popular uprisings starting from Occupy and coming down to Black Lives Matter and the Bernie Sanders Revolution. And she has, I think, very insightfully analyzed what are the strengths and weaknesses of these movements and, more to the point, what binds them all together as a one momentum. And I'm happy to say that in the end, she's got reason for optimism. She says, quote, that Americans are poised to permanently remake politics as we know it, and in some cases they are already succeeding. So the name of that book is Necessary Trouble. There are several documentary films coming out, one on John Lewis and the labor revolution, and one on Brian Wilson, who is called the Paying the Price for Peace, and that's just out now, and it looks like a very moving documentary. Brian, as you remember, is the young man who lost his legs trying to stop a weapons train here in California. He's become a very, very active peace activist. There's also a new website called Peace Studies Digest. Well, it's not really that new, but to be perfectly honest, it was new to me, even though peace studies was my field. And this is being supported by the Jubitz Foundation up here in Washington. But, well, folks, I've been holding myself back, but I want to tell you about three wonderful resources now, and I'm going to start off with mentioning a book. It's a children's book, and it's called Gandhi Searches for Truth, A Practical Biography for Children. And it is written by none other than our hostess, Stephanie Van Hook. I've seen this book. I've read it. I've handled it. It's absolutely beautiful. It's extremely, it's expertly written in a way, because Stephanie is a Montessori teacher who deals with children of this age group and is able to really talk to them without talking down to them. So it's a book that the children themselves can understand, and it can be read to them by their parents. And gosh, since you're right here in the studio, Stephanie, let me ask you, what drew you to write Gandhi Searches for Truth?
Well, Michael, I couldn't have planned this interview better. So I wrote Gandhi Searches for Truth for the children at the Montessori school where I work with 3 to 6-year-olds in particular. But since I've been working at the school, we've been talking a lot about Mahatma Gandhi, and they're really drawn to him. They're drawn to him because they think he's good and they're learning a lot about bad guys in the world. So what about the good guys, in a way? And so we're trying, as we have these conversations of going beyond good guys and bad guys, we want to show real peacemakers in the world and what they've been doing, and this legacy of Mahatma Gandhi in particular, because that's where my interest lies. So I was looking for a really good biography to be able to share with them, and I really couldn't find something that spoke to nonviolence and peace building and his biography in a way that really made sense for that age group, but also that combined those things as well as I would have liked them to do. I would have had to keep offering something else. So I just started telling them stories, and finally I decided over the summer I would just put it into a book format for them. So,
well, one thing that I like very much about the book is that it doesn't get shy of the spiritual dimensions of nonviolence. It talks about Gandhi learning to use a mantra and so forth. And I know that you've been reading the book with your children there in the Montessori school, chapter by chapter. How is it going?
Well, the children know Gandhi's mantra was Rama, and they know that that's a word that they can use, and it doesn't necessarily have spiritual overtones for them. It's something that simply means joy, and it's a word that Gandhi used to help him calm his mind and his body, which the children are often looking for tools to help them because they're new in their bodies. Mm. Their bodies are new to them, and they need something when they get overly excited or they get upset to have that tool there ready for them. So in the book, it does say anybody who wants to be calm and peaceful can try out this word if they'd like. Similarly, if people are interested in learning about mantras, they can learn more about that from the Blue Mountain Center of Meditation's website, which is ishwaran.org, who's my spiritual teacher.
Could you spell that for us?
From my head, EASWARAN.org.
Thank you.
So the children are responding well, though, because I'm reading only one chapter per month, and it's just 500 words, but we read the lesson of the chapter, we read the chapter, and then throughout the month, we retell the story in various ways, in the children's own words, or we repeat it, because it's there's a lot of information in each of these 500 words, and sometimes the children are just working on a vocabulary word. Other children are working on, you know, putting the whole concept together, and we're doping it out in practice, as you say. Mm-hmm. So Gandhi searches for truth. What does that mean? Truth isn't something that you think with your mind or taste with your senses or hear or smell. It's something that you feel with your heart. And that's something they understand immediately. They're the ones. I said, where do you find truth? They said, in your heart, of course. So as we go through the day and through the weeks, we can talk about, well, is this a truthful moment for you? And it brings out the principles through experience, which is really what makes this book practical, why it's called a practical biography for children.
Let me ask you this. You are uniquely positioned to tell the story and to use this book. Now, if someone else, say a parent or a teacher, were to pick up the book, would they be able to use it? Is there enough material there that would help them do what you're doing with your children?
Absolutely. So Maria Montessori saw that it wasn't just working on the children that would make society more peaceful, but rather it was about rebuilding the relationship and the awareness between grown-ups and children, that bond, that sacred bond between the next generation and the current leaders, you know, current grown-ups of the world, the fully developed human being to the extent that we are as we're grown-ups. We keep evolving. So to that end, I recommend that people get the book and they read it themselves, because that's really what the book is for as well. It's for the grown-ups to learn a little bit more about the principles of nonviolence through the eyes of their children. How would you explain nonviolence or civil disobedience or nonviolent non-cooperation or coercion with a child? And, you know, they say that I used to be a philosophy major, so they said that you really understand a concept as well if you can explain it to a three-year-old. So I always remembered that. So learn about, I recommend to teachers and other grown-ups to go to these books, and this book in particular, and to learn a little bit about Gandhi's life you know, it's a biography. How interesting can a biography be? You know,
biography could be pretty darn interesting.
It's a biography, but it's also full of ideas about how nonviolence works, which a lot of grown-ups don't know about.
Yeah.
So then you get to explain it to children in your own words, if that's easier. You know, you read it to yourself, and then you decide, based on the child in front of you or next to you who would like to read this book with you, how can you explain it based on some of the guidelines that I've given in each chapter?
You touched on a very practical question, Stephanie. How can people get the book?
Ah, okay. Well, they can find the book at the website for the Meta Center, which is Meta Center with two T's, METTACenter.org, because we just got in a shipment of books, and I am offering them signed out of the office for this first shipment, and you can find out more about that on our website or on our Facebook page as well. You can find out how to find it there. And it's also, it does happen to be on other networks, like, you know, where people buy books and all kinds of things.
No names, please.
Yeah.
While you were speaking, I was reminded of some of the wonderful stories that Narayan Desai told. He was only a little bit older than that when he was growing up in Gandhi's ashram.
Right.
And he tells how they had gotten a shipment of toys from the UK, but Gandhi wasn't releasing these toys to the children. And the children designated Narayan as their spokeschild. And he went in and he said, "I understand we've got some toys." And Gandhi, of course, said yes. And he said, "Well, I want to play with them."
Right.
And Gandhi said to him, "Can we use foreign goods?" And he apparently used a word for "we" in Gujarati, which is a special term that really includes the speaker and the listener.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just remarkable how Narayan got it, that they were all part of this wonderful movement together, and he had an opportunity to make a sacrifice for India's freedom, and that stayed with him his whole life.
And, you know, that brings up a lot for me. That's a beautiful story because it shows that, you know, Narayan Desai dedicated his entire life to building institutions that would make a more nonviolent world, from, you know, the education system that was inspired by Gandhi's leadership, from somebody who worked intimately with Gandhi ever since he was a child, as well as the Shanti Sena, the peace army, was led and helped to be initiated through Narayan Desai. So it started when he was a child, and it was a lifelong search. So it shows how important it is to begin when we're young. If you plant those seeds early, they can be very rich and lead to the real nonviolent institutions that make the world better. Because when we understand these ideas conceptually as children, we carry it with us. Now, Gandhi helped Narayan to understand Swadeshi, or, you know, localism, conceptually with Narayan, because he's saying, "Can we play with these toys? Let's think about this together." And that is really a way of including children, their full humanity, into the nonviolent discussion, into a discussion. In a lot, you know, dealing and working with children, we could say very easily, "No, you may not play with these toys. I'm sorry. I'm the grown-up. I get to decide." But what does that teach them? That teaches them that somebody else gets to make choices. And so then, you know, well, I'm at conflict with people in my environment. They don't let me have the things I want. I'm going to have to do whatever I can to get them. So it shows that it's a very subtle practice, and it's very humbling for a grown-up to have to begin to reorient themselves to being more inclusive to the deeper needs of the child, which isn't so much to play with the toys, but it's to feel heard and to be included, which is really the human need.
And of course, the real tragedy there is if you say to a child, no, you can't, period, no. Don't think for yourself. Then what is that child going to do when they grow up? They're going to be authoritarian as well.
That's the idea.
And think of the amazing trust in the truth that Gandhi had to be able to include that very young child with him, who was the son of his secretary. Gosh.
Right. Well, Maria de Montessori, I want to say that these ideas aren't just coming from, you know, Mahatma Gandhi, but even Maria Montessori was a peace educator. So these, and she met Gandhi and had great respect for him, and he actually had great respect for her as well. And she even said that if we want children to build better societies where there aren't dictators, then we shouldn't teach them to obey the parent dictator. Mm. We shouldn't tyrannize them as their preside over them as tyrants. Mm. And it's something that sounds okay, fine, but really test it out in your experience and see how often when you're with children that you're telling them what to do instead of working with them to engage their thinking skills to have the ideas that will make them safe that they can carry on their own, and they see that, you know, you're working with them, not bossing them around.
You see how much just comes from a discussion of this beautiful book. One other quick thing, Stephanie, before we leave this topic. I understand you're working on a peace curriculum that will be for the same age group that will accompany the book.
That's right. Yes. So it includes some podcasts called Person Power Podcast and some resources for parents, as well as words for children to explore, such as forgiveness and nonviolence and compassion, so that they can understand these words and what they look like in practice and to help them become peacemakers.
Well, that is so encouraging. And we have a couple of other resources that I'd like to share with you really quickly. One is I wrote an open letter to Bernie supporters, and that has been put up on our website as a whiteboard animation. And it's been seen by, probably about 13,000 people by now and reached about 40,000. And I'm really hoping that this will be something that helps to promote useful and constructive conversations among our revolution movements. And just to skip ahead a little bit to the events section, in November 12th and 13th, there will be a big conference in Berkeley that's co-sponsored by Rabbi Michael Lerner and your humble servant, and be precisely for the purpose of convening some of these new activists who've been awakened since Occupy and to try to see if we couldn't form a cohesive strategy for taking us forward. And the other resource I'd like to mention is the latest in our series of news story animation videos has come out. And I wonder, Stephanie, could we play the audio so that people get a sense of what goes on in that thing, amusing as it is to watch?
We could play it for a couple minutes.
Let's do that.
Okay, here we go.
In the news, in our lives, terrorism is everywhere. The U.S. military is fighting an endless, borderless war on terror. But bombs and drones are just making terrorists faster than we can kill them. Isn't there a better way to deal with this? You bet. It shows up the minute we drop this old story of separateness and competition and violence, and then start over from a different, new story perspective. The 9/11 attacks, the KKK's lynchings of African Americans, the Unabomber, the recent events at the hands of ISIS, these are all examples of terrorism. And in every case, there's one thing we have to understand. Beneath the label of terrorist is a human being. When we remove labels like...
I think that is extremely intriguing, and people can go to metacenter.org to see that animation right now and give us your feedback. And so I'd like to mention a few other things that are happening in our world. One is I'm very happy to report, though it's a little bit nervous-making, there is another boat that is on its way to Gaza. You all may remember the flotillas and the difficulties, the deaths that took place on the Mavi Marmara a couple of years ago, but the attempt goes on to break the siege of Gaza, an example of what we call firmeza permanente. And speaking of enduring firmness, let me talk a little bit about the Standing Rock Sioux demonstration that's going on in North Dakota. It's been going on since April against the Dakota Access Pipeline. the Council of the Standing Rock Sioux have actually declared that they are for nonviolence, and they're using a range of tactics from obstruction, getting in the way of construction equipment, to actually suing the Army Corps of Engineers, along with the support of three other federal agencies. Well, there's so much more going on, and I hope to share it with you in our next episode. But right now, Stephanie, take us off.
We want to thank all of our listeners and our mother station, KWMR, all of the staff and volunteers of the Meta Center for Nonviolence. And until the next time, everyone, take care of... Oh, why don't we thank our guest? Thank you to Alice Slater from the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation and World Beyond War, who joined us for a very informative interview. Until the next time, everybody, take care of one another. Bye.